Well, good morning. And first of all, thank you very much for inviting me to speak this morning. I'm always a little intimidated when I speak with a group of men like this. You guys are the most intelligent, articulate, knowledgeable people I've met in AA. And I always feel a little bit second class being with you, arriving at this meeting at this point in my life the way I did. My name is George Anderson. I am an alcoholic, and my sobriety date is 2000 January, excuse me, June. See, I told you I was nervous. June 20th, 2002. I live in Youngstown, New York. I've been privileged to be at this meeting, not from the very beginning, but close to the beginning. My story begins right here in this area. I grew up here on a farm in Eastern Niagara County. I was a farm kid growing up in the 50s. A lot of the lifestyle that I had at that point is extinct at this time. Family farms don't exist anymore. Kids don't grow up in that environment anymore. Kids don't have the responsibilities I had growing up like that anymore. I grew up basically alone in a lot of ways. I'd get off that big yellow bus and I'd go up to the farm. My friends would be in town, and I would spend the rest of the day until I got on that big yellow bus in the morning and rode back, basically with a mother and a dog and a job list. Now, I grew up with people who had no concept of Dr. Spock. The people that I grew up with basically considered a child to be a younger, smaller version of an adult. So you were given adult responsibilities when you were able to do them. If you were big enough to do the job was yours. It was very simple. And by the time I was 12, I was a big kid. I was old enough to reach the controls of the tractor. By 12 and 13, I was driving tractor and doing field work. And that was just part of the lifestyle. And I just accepted that as the way things were. I came home to a mother initially. But when I was about 10 years old, she began having problems dropping things, having trouble walking. The doctor's diagnosed the problem, and it was MS. So from about the time I was 10 or 11 until she died later on when I was 21, became gradually sicker and sicker and more disabled. And as she became more and more disabled, more and more of that responsibility fell more. That responsibility fell in my direction. I was using a garden hoe long before I used a bat in a baseball game. As she got older and more disabled, I took on more and more responsibilities, as I said. By the time I was in seventh and eighth grade, she was in a wheelchair. She would sit in the kitchen. She would tell me what to do and how to do it. And together we would prepare an evening meal. That's how it worked. And it the that sense of being and feeling different became very, very pronounced at that point in my life. I think I was born an alcoholic. I can never remember not feeling different, not feeling less than, not feeling quite measuring up to other people that I saw, never quite fitting in. And as time went on, I discovered that I was doing things at home that nobody else was. And whenever I felt different was kind of another word for feeling less than. So I can never remember not feeling less than. And to me, that was just a way of life. You know, there was something in me that was less than, and I never, as much as I didn't like it, I never knew what to do about it. So when I was 15, big kid that I was, hanging out with the older kids that I was, I went to a birthday party for a girl who was 18. And of course, in New York at that point, you could drink when you were 18. And the first time I drank was at that party. I drank a six pack of beer. I drank a pint of wine. I got terribly, horribly drunk and sick. Was dumped off at my back door, got in all sorts of trouble. But when after I took those first drinks, there was another guy in me that came out that never showed up before. He could smile, he could laugh, he could dance, he felt as though he fit in. He was joking. He was a kind of person that I wanted to be. In fact, he was the kind of person that I liked better than the kind of person that was inside of me walking around sober. So I liked that person. And so I pursued the alcohol. And no matter how bad I felt from that first morning on, there was a part of me that liked that feeling and liked that alcohol and wanted to do it again. And from 15 on until I came into the program in 2002, I pursued alcohol. So I think basically, as I say, I was an alcohol waiting for that first drink. And once that first drink hit me, it never stopped. But basically, I partied. I consider myself a partier at that point in time. Finished school, finished college, didn't realize how the alcoholism was progressing. In college, blackout drinking was a regular thing. I disregarded it. Vomiting blood from time to time was something that happened. I disregarded it. Restless, irritable, discontented, part of my life story. Got married, started a family, going to get all professional and start living that nice life. But that restless, irritable, and discontented part of me just wouldn't settle down. So we moved out to Michigan, and I started school out there, figuring, well, I've got this licked. I've got the wife, I've got the kid, I've got my funding, I've got a career path, I've got my work that I can do, and I thought I was off to a good start. But as it turned out, it was just a great case of overreach. The boy got sick, and the doctor's bills piled up. This was during the protest years. College campuses were in an uproar. Advisors were leaving. It was difficult to get a program started. The debts kept building up. My wife was frustrated that she wasn't part of the action, and eventually she left. So, in a space of about 4 weeks, literally 4 weeks, my wife left. She took the boy. I lost my home. I lost my funding. I lost a career path. I found myself saddled with child support and academic debts to pay off. It was not a good time for this kid. And up until then, I had partied, but when that hit me, my drinking changed. And instead of partying, I started drinking on a daily basis, sometimes in the morning, sometimes not. But at every opportunity, even more aggressively, I drank and was using some of the local homegrown that was available at that point in time as well. So between the two, I started working my way through that. Now, I swore I was going to do this on my own. I was going to get this done all by myself. And so I did it alone, all by myself. And it was a shit show. I got through it by numbing up. I got through it by drinking too much and drugging too much. And for the next several years, that's my life went into a tailspin. I went back home, started living with a father who was not feeling well and who subsequently needed help, and started paying off the child, the academic debts, and started paying that child support and doing all the things that people who are divorced have to do. Now, when I was during that time, I did two things. That's when that work hard, play hard ethic that I had grown up with really reasserted itself. Because if I wasn't working, I was playing hard, which is a euphemism for drinking. And in the course of doing that, my big concern was getting out of debt, getting that period of life behind me. So I took every job I could find. I lived cheap. Did every extra duty I could find for the little extra money, and I paid that debt off in about half the time that was asking me. And I can remember sending in that last check on that academic debt, and filled with anger, filled with contempt, filled with disregard for people, just looking at that check and realizing two things. Number one, how much I hated paying that money. But on the other hand, how much relief I was getting. That was the last check I sent in to pay off that debt. I don't know if you guys have ever paid off a big debt, like a mortgage to a house, maybe a big car loan or something. But when I paid off that debt, there was just this huge relief that came over me. Now, I was still, I still had other responsibilities. That's okay. But that debt was gone, and I hated that debt. The other things I could manage. And all of a sudden, after these years of struggling with that and struggling with the anger, I realized that that period of time was behind me, and I had choices to make. What was I going to do now that I wasn't busily taking up and repairing all that issues from the past? And basically, I had two choices. Number one, I could buy a house, get settled in, start raising the family, live that normal teaching life that most people live. But then I got thinking about it. And when I was a kid on that farm, my uncle got me a subscription to the National Geographic. Now, I was about 7 years old when that magazine started coming. I couldn't read the articles, but I could look at the pictures. And that magazine would come, and I would take that magazine and I would go up in my room for hours just looking at those pictures of these strange places, these beautiful places, these beautiful mountains, these mountains that were terraced into rice paddies, these snow fields, these beautiful oceans, all the strange peoples. And I would sit up there for hours just devouring that magazine until the next one showed up a month later. And I would do the same thing with that magazine. I saved every single one of them from about the 1948, 49 to about 1963 when I finally stopped coming home. They were all on my shelf and they were all dog-eared and pawed apart from being looked at so much. Oddly enough, no coincidence here. In college, my favorite course was geography. Coincidentally, I was working as a teacher and I was teaching about the Afro-Asian world, Africa, excuse me, including Latin America, all these places that I'd read about in Geographic. So here I was at this point in my life where I could make some choices. The house, the middle class, doing that was one thing. But it dawned on me, I finally had a chance to visit those places that I'd been reading about and teaching about my entire life. I had expat friends in Australia. I contacted them. I talked with my employer, and I got a year's leave of absence to travel in Asia. So in 1978, I had sold everything I could sell, got rid of everything I could get rid of, parked my old beater car behind a friend's barn, picked up a backpack and flew from Buffalo, New York to Sydney, Australia. And began that year off. I stayed with expat friends in Brisbane, answered an ad in the newspaper, crewed up along the east coast of Australia up through the Barrier Reef, snorkeling in the reef, foraging for food along the shore, taking that sailing trip and recycling back with a bunch of guys who were out capturing wild boar in the outback. They call it pigging. Spent time with them, tried to, and came back to Brisbane, tried to make ends meet by working under the table, black they called it, illegally, but I couldn't make ends meet. The Australian dollar was worth $1.20 US. I was hemorrhaging money, couldn't make it, so I had to make another choice. At which point, I got rid of more stuff, bought an airplane ticket, went from Sydney, Australia to Perth, to Denpasar, Bali, and flew to Bali, landing in at Denpasar Airport at 11:30 at night in the middle of a monsoon rain, made my way into town, and for the rest of the time of that year, I spent that time traveling across Asia on the cheap. Now, traveling on the cheap in those days meant this. Number one, you stayed out of any tourist bubble that might have existed, which of course really didn't exist in that part of the world at that point in time. This is 1978 we're talking. But what you did is you used local transport. You ate in local restaurants. You did your bookings with local people. You tried to live as close to the people that you were traveling through as you could. And that's what I did. Traveling overland through Indonesia to Jakarta. I did take a plane into Singapore because if you flew into Singapore, you got a 2-week visa. If you came by sea, you got a 1-week visa, and I wanted the extra week. So I flew into Singapore. Got cheap housing, dormitory housing, and began to continue on that trip. My budget was $3 a day. I had $1 for lodging, $1 for food, and then $1 to splash about as any way I wanted, which is kind of a joke because it really didn't go that far. So I had this cheap budget, traveling on the cheap, and was in Singapore, moved up into Malaysia. This is 1978. Boat people were coming out of Vietnam. I stayed in places where boat people were housed. I got to tell you, the graffiti on the wall would break your heart. On up in through Malaysia, watched boat people getting literally shoved back into the sea by Malaysian police. Was ready to leave Malaysia. Got to Thailand, and lo and behold, that geographic moment, hit me like a brick. Into Bangkok, and now. There was that part of me. Remember, now I'm drinking at this point. I didn't come in the program. So this trail that I was on, this path that I was on, was called the old hippie trail that went from Sydney to London. Now the hippie trail was a combination of travel and drugs. So I did a lot of traveling. I sampled a fair bit of drugs. Alcohol was not part of my story. It was too expensive. And for some reason, I didn't have the urge to drink. So I would go long periods of time without alcohol, occasional use here and there. Thailand, of course, is a whole nother story because that was a whole culture, especially in the north. So I traveled up through Thailand, got connected with a girl and her Australian boyfriend, and trekked up into North Thailand. Thailand, they called the Golden Triangle back then. I don't know what it's called today, but up near the Thai Burma Chinese border, and we were up there for a week trekking in the jungle. It was really that moment I was looking for. We were in villages where people had never seen Europeans, typically very young and very old. We dodged pack trains. It was during the opium harvest. So we were dodging pack trains heading north, up carrying the raw opium up into north, excuse me, South China, North Burma for processing. Got through okay, had a great time. Continued on to Burma, Rangoon, traveled up country in Rangoon. I got to tell you, it was kind of a mixture of geographic moments and just flagrant disregard and pleasure seeking. So I kind of went back and forth. Opium was cheap in Burma, so I used it. But the other thing was, when the English were in Burma, they taught the Burmese how to brew beer, and Burma had some of the most beautiful bitter ale that you would ever want to drink in hot weather. We had made several of us had made so much money on the black market in Burma, buying and selling cigarettes. We really didn't know what to do with it. If we tried to get it out of the country, it would have triggered alarms all over the place. So we wandered around, and one day we were down by the waterfront with this money in our pockets. We stumbled across a building that must have been an old officer's mess during the Raj, maybe a club of sorts. But they were serving up this beautiful beer, and we sat there and we just drank that money up, left the country, and headed on into India. But Burma was incredibly corrupt, and you could do that sort of thing. I don't know if you could do it today, but back then it was just a huge game. Take a risk, no big deal. We'll get by. Nobody will say anything. And so we did it. Into India, up into Nepal, hiked in the Himalayas up there, came down, saw the religious sites in Varanasi and all the pageantry and all the poetry of that holy city. Everything from painted sadhus and flowers to an old guy, not an old guy, a young guy, skin and bone. Covered with dirt, dressed in a loincloth, never forget it, walking through the crowd down to the steps to have. He was carrying a little bundle in his arms, wrapped in this beautiful white cloth. So it was a father carrying the body of a baby down to the steps to be blessed by the sadhus, by the priests down there. and set adrift in the Ganges in hopes that his soul would be released from that reincarnation cycle. The poignant moment for me. And still remains, obviously. Traveling across India, third class on the trains, visiting, you know, visiting the historical sites, the Taj at moonlight, that sort of thing. And got to Delhi, and my intention was to go Pakistan, Afghanistan, Iran, Turkey, get through, okay? And I ran into a snag. This has been months on the road. I hadn't heard of, I'd gotten sort of rumors about problems in the Middle East. I didn't quite know what was going on. Pakistan apparently was okay to travel, but once you got to Afghanistan, that was, I didn't know. And Iran, there was a religious leader named Khomeini that had come back to Iran while I was traveling. Iran was off limits to American. The anti-Americanism there was just too strong. So I went to the consulate in Delhi and asked him about travel through to Turkey. And he said, and then it through Afghanistan into Turkey. And they said, well, you can do it, but you better read this fact sheet first. And they gave me a sheet of paper. It was single space, two sides, single space, with travel tips about traveling in Afghanistan. You know, don't go out at night alone. Don't talk to local women. Don't get involved with drugs and alcohol. Okay, all that I could take. Stay at licensed hotels. Okay, I could do that. It was the first statement that really impressed me. And it said basically this. It said, notify your next of kin regarding your dates of entry and exit from the country. And it was just that simple statement right at the beginning, which convinced me that perhaps Afghanistan was not a choice I should be making. At which point I was in a conundrum. How do you do this? How do you travel on the cheap when that overland route is gone? So I went to travel north into India, a place called Manali, where they'd opened up a road the year previous so you could get a bus transportation up to it. Went up there they had a bus once a week that came up. I went up there for a couple of weeks. It was like Switzerland 500 years ago. Alpine forests, beautiful snowpack, monastery up in the hills overlooking the city, full moon, monks with these long alpenhorn blowing these mournful sounds out into the valleys on those full moon nights. It was spiritual. And during that time up there, of course, I took advantage of some of these great high mountain hashish, which was just part of the deal when you're traveling in that area of the world. And eventually came back to Delhi, and I had to fly over to Athens, then loop back around in through Turkey, hitchhiked through Turkey to Istanbul, spent some time in Istanbul, hitchhiked from Istanbul to Athens, picked up the back half of a round-trip ticket from Athens to London, and traveled up to London. I had to spend some time in Greece because I had time to kill, so I just found this little island called Patmos through the tourist bureau. I could stay on the beach, so I slept on the beach for about a month in Patmos, traveling and talking with other Europeans, enjoying the rest and relaxation before I headed on in. Met an English, excuse me, a New Zealand guy and his English girlfriend that I subsequently stayed with in London, excuse me, outside London, a little place called Somerset. And my money was really low at that point. They found me a job. I worked for a week. That money gave me money to get through back to London. And there was a guy that had a cheap flight from New York to London, a guy named Freddie Laker. I don't know if you remember that. He ran charter flights, ridiculously cheap. I booked one of those. I wound up in New York and eventually came home and went back to work. I'd taken 14 months to do that travel. Now, the reason why I spend time on this is a couple of things. Number one, if you ask me why I did that, I used to say, well, it was an adventure, it was fun, it was good times. Then I got into AA, and I look back on things, and I'm saying, maybe this is immature, gross over-exaggeration. Maybe it's this alcoholic immaturity coming out. I've given up on the motive. All I know is I had the experience, and I could carry that experience back into the classroom and into my life. And some of the best teaching I ever did was in the years following that. I stopped giving lectures. I started telling stories. They enjoyed the stories more than the lecture. They learned more from the stories than the lectures. I enjoyed talking. I always enjoy talking about myself. So it was a good relationship. And there was this beautiful little, cute little math teacher. I don't say beautiful, cute little math teacher. They had lunch with me. And she used to get into my shit. You know, she used to really love hearing my shit. And the more I talked, the more attractive she became, and the deeper the relationship came, and we fell in love. And God bless her, we got married a year later, and we stayed married for the next 40 years. Now, she was this type A linear math teacher. Everything had a procedure, everything had a structure, everything had a one right answer. I was an alcoholic, you know, describe me as you will. But the point is, people thought that we were going to be clashing. It would never last. They looked, oh God, they'll never last. The thing they didn't realize, and I've said before in here, I think, is the fact that we dovetailed. She, like the free spirit and that she found in me, I like the home building that I found in her and never had growing up. And between the two of us, we put together a life that included both home building and travel over the course of our marriage. So it was a good relationship. Our sons were living their adult lives. Basically, by that time, my son had a granddaughter. And later on in our marriage, my son's daughter was diagnosed with childhood leukemia. Reason I mention this is my second bottom incident. I'd always had problems with God when I was growing up. The problems with my mother was always explained, oh, it's blood, God's plan, God's plan. I'd heard enough of that. Now all of a sudden, the granddaughter had leukemia, and she had no reason. They had no business having leukemia when I was there. And so I cursed God again for taking her and not me. And I just assumed when I heard those words that she was going to die, that I had just given up. And I gave up on God, and I went into the bottle even more and more heavily. I can remember I told before, sitting in my shop alone, bottle next to me on the floor, saying, "If it God, if it wasn't for alcohol, I wouldn't have a friend." And that's exactly the way I felt. Subsequently, of course, she did survive. She's normal, healthy girl at this point. But that was my second real bottom. We continued on. The drinking kept getting worse and worse as a result of that. It was more and more compulsive, more drinking, more frequent, greater amounts. I went up to Lake Placid. We had a camp outside Lake Placid. I went up there to saying to myself, well, if I go up there, I'll take some time out. I'll get straightened around. Da, da. I got up there. I don't know how long I was there, but I bought a 12-pack of beer on the way into the place. 120 minutes later, 12 bottles are gone, and I'm standing there saying, Jesus, what's next? So, of course, what next is more alcohol. And I was there 3 days, maybe 4 days. I don't know, but that's when I hit my final bottom. That's when I realized I could not control the drinking. And that was a point in my life where I was so demoralized that I could not stand living with myself in these conditions anymore. I came back in time for a physical exam with this doctor that I'd never seen before. I mentioned this, I think, here. One of those men over 50 physicals you're supposed to get every year. And so I went in to see this doctor, and here's this young guy sitting there. He looks like he's 12 years old. He looks like he just bought his shirt out of the boys' department at Kmart, and he's sitting there with a smile on his face. And I'm sitting down in this taste of incredible demoralization, just insufferable, pitiful demoralization. And he looks up at me and he says, well, you know, how's it going? And all of a sudden, there was a catch in my voice. And I just verbally exploded, vomited all over his desk, this problem of drinking too much, feeling so bad, demoralization, the absolute desperation, the sadness, the anger. I just dumped all of this pent-up alcoholism and alcoholic thinking on his desk right there in the spot. Now, the guy had never seen me before, right? But he sat there and listened to me, and he said, "You need AA." And I kind of had a little bit of moment of hesitation. He says, "You need AA." And I said, "Okay." Now this is how desperate I was. Okay? When you're desperate, you do things that you don't normally do. Okay? Now, I didn't realize how desperate I was, but I did two things that I normally wouldn't have done. Number one, I listened to his advice. And number two, I acted on his advice. I mean, that's how desperate I was. And the next day, I showed up at an AA, excuse me, 2 days later, I showed up at an AA meeting. Called ahead of time, excuse me, I found AA. I had no idea what I was dealing with. So I went to the Yellow Pages and found AA in the Yellow Pages, found a phone number, called the phone number, a voice answered, and I said, "How do I get forms to join AA?" And there was this moment of silence on the phone. And this guy says, "Well, it doesn't work that way. We've got a meeting at noon. Just show up." So the next day I showed up at that noon meeting, and that was my first AA meeting. No rehab, no detox. I just walked in, saw these guys I'd never seen before, sat down, and let the meeting unfold. I think I mentioned before that was the place where I first said, "My name is George. I'm an alcoholic," out loud. And that was that first meeting where I stood, I sat there. I thought it was the worst moment of my life. I had no idea how I got there. I had no idea what was going to happen. I knew I felt terrible. And these guys were sitting there, and I'd never seen them before. So I had no idea what was going to happen next and what was happening now. They started talking about God. I started twitching and hanging in my seat. I almost left. Conversation shifted. I stayed on. At the end of the meeting, got up and left, and something had happened. I know I've mentioned this. For some reason, somehow, I felt a little bit better than when I had walked in. And I got to tell you, I had been feeling so bad for so long. That sensation of just a little bit better for me was huge. It brought me back the next day, and the same thing happened. And I went back the third day, and the fourth day, and fifth day, etc. And I've been coming back ever since. Now, I still had problems with the God thing, okay? But at least I showed up. And I did the best I could. I'd like to think I did the best I could. I kept showing up at meetings, doing what they told me to do. I read in the big book, I needed a power greater than myself, and the power greater than myself that I could willingly attach myself to was the power of the program, the power of the meeting, the power in the meetings themselves. And over time, the voices in the meetings for me became the voice of God. It wasn't God, but it was the voice. And it carried the message, and it got me through. And when I came time to look for a sponsor, I was told, "When you're ready for a sponsor, God will put one in your path." And I said, "Okay, I'll trust God." If you notice a little bit of ambivalence and confusion here, you're not alone, because I couldn't quite figure this out either. I just did what the program told me. They said, "When you were ready for one, one would appear." And so I did. I stopped worrying. And lo and behold, the sponsor showed up. We clicked immediately. He's still a sponsor for me today. We've been sponsored now ever since I came in. And he's very, very active as he was then. So I trusted the program, as I trusted the program more than I could trust God. To me, trust and faith are two huge items. I could trust in the program before I could have faith in a higher power. But the trust is what carried me through those early days. It took me 14 months to do the steps, but I finally did the steps with my sponsor after having kind of an aha moment in a meeting and realizing that God had been active in my life. And once I realized that there had been a higher power, God, active in my life, I could say, "Oh, okay, I can do this." I could make the decision to turn life and will over to the care of God and move on to four. Now, keep in mind, when I first came into the program, the gift, G-O-D, gift of desperation, took me to a doctor that I'd never seen before. And a guy that if I met would immediately just blow off just because of his appearance, prejudgment. But that doctor sent me to a GOD group of drunks who sat with me in meetings for months and helped me get sober. Now, I had drunk, by the time I walked into that meeting, I'd been drinking for over 45 years. I used the term 500 months because 4 months into the program, I am saying to myself, 4 months into the program, I looked up from my desk one day and realized I did not have the compulsion to drink. And I could not remember when I had last had the compulsion to drink. Now, that was 4 months out of 500 months of drinking. That group of drunks had shown me a good orderly direction to reach a point where that compulsion to drink had been lifted. And I could still sit there and say, no, there's no God in my life. Okay? You know, it's not me. I still rejected the idea of opening myself to the concept of a loving and willing God. So it's been a thorny journey for me. But I did 4 and 5, and I felt this incredible relief with 4 and 5. 6 and 7, you guys know I've had problems with that. The idea of a complete character change frightened me. It was too much for me to put my hands around. But I knew that if I did 8 and I did 9, I would feel better because the program told me I would feel better. So I went on to 8 and I did my inventory, okay? The amends list. And I began to take out number 9, do my amends. The first guy that I made an amends to was a guy that I had insulted terribly at a meeting early on. A community action meeting that I was in early on. I was half drunk when I was in there. I was angry and I was just rude. Okay. Even I was ashamed at how badly I treated him at the time. And he was one of the first on my amends list after Eileen, of course. And as God would have it, we showed up at sometime later on at the same meeting. He looked at me and he avoided me and went off to a different section of the room. I had been told that when it was time for me to make an amend, you know, God would put that person in my path. It was my responsibility to be ready to make that amend when that event happened. So as soon as I saw him in that room, I said to myself, okay, this is it. Hike up your britches, walk over and make the amends. So I walked over to him. His name was Dave. I walked over to him and I stuck out my hand and I said, Dave, I have an apology to make to you. I treated you very badly and I'm ashamed of that. And I just want to let you know that I will never, ever treat you that way again. And he was stunned. He didn't know what to say. But he accepted the apology. I made the amend and we chatted for a minute. Then we parted. Dave and I were never friends, but making that amend was an incredibly powerful, I realized what an incredibly powerful healing tool that can be. Because we could work together, we could treat each other with respect, but like I said, never be friends. So making the amends list started off well with me. And I continued to make those amends. And I continued to do the best I could with conscious contact with a higher power. I could easily do 10. I could make an amend when things happened and not let things, you know, pile up like they did before. Conscious contact with a higher power, God, 11. It was a struggle for me, but I tried to stay in contact with my higher power as best I could and the AA program as best I could. Carrying the message, practicing these principles and all my affairs, I thought I was doing pretty good at that. So I continued on working the program, knowing that I was deficient with the concept of a higher power. We were living in the Adirondacks. My wife's family was getting older. She had a sister who died from cancer. Cancer runs in her family. My wife was very upset. She wasn't closer to be with her sister. We decided it was time to pull the wagons into a little tighter circle. And we decided to move back here so Eileen could be closer to her family. That was that, I had no problem with that. It was important to her. That was important to me. We sold the place up there before it was even listed. God guided. We bought the place here overlooking the river in Youngstown before it was even listed. God guided. We found a mover. We found a storage man. We found people living here. We let their tent. We let their lease run out. We moved in. Everything was incredibly smooth. God guided. We moved in August. We started sleeping here in August of 2017. We were still moving in when Christmas came. Excuse me, when Thanksgiving came. For the first time in years, we spent Christmas with Eileen's family and came home to our own house. Christmas, same thing. Time with her family, came home to our own house. New Year's, basically the same thing. So we still had things to unpack. I was still kind of fixing things up. We were still getting settling in. And shortly after New Year's, Eileen started getting this pain in her abdomen. She thought it was a UTI, uterine infection. The pain continued, it got worse. We took her to the emergency room. They did some tests and they discovered that she had peritonitis. And by the time that they got the test back from peritonitis, further tests revealed that it had changed from peritonitis to sepsis. And she was seriously ill. I phoned the family, I phoned the boys. They started mainlining antibiotics into her, and but she continued to fail. We put her on life support on January 12th. January 13th, there was no improvement. I sat vigil with her on the 13th. Came home late on the morning of the 14th. The doctor called. She'd had a very bad night. We made the decision to pull life support and suspend life support that day. I called my sister-in-law, who was sort of the head of the top of the telephone tree, told her that I just made a decision. Enough was enough. She'd gone through enough. Time to let her go. So they began withdrawing her from life support on the morning of the 14th, at 4:54 p.m. She passed away. And that was it. I just In literally in about 4 days, everything fell apart and it hit me like a brick. And I had no idea what to do, anger, frustration, terror, all of the gamut of the emotions that I went through in drinking came rushing back. And we went through all of the routine. We went through the burial, da, 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 da. Had all the food here, da, da, da. And as I've said before, there came a time I walked in the house. It was empty. It was lifeless. And I knew that I could not go on like that. I had been searching for help. I had no problem with help. I found a counselor through Niagara Hospice for almost 2.5 years. He and I talked. And I used the steps to guide the recovery. He was flexible enough. I knew that the program worked. I could apply these principles in all my affairs, even the most unimaginable. So I began to use the steps. Number one, I was powerless over that death, and my life was unmanageable. I worked on powerlessness and the inability to manage my life. Okay? Acceptance. We worked on that for weeks and proceeded through the steps. A power greater than myself to help me deal with this situation. I had a grief sponsor, quote unquote, grief counselor to help me initially. Worked through the steps six and seven, excuse me, four and five. Did a deep look at the marriage and the marriage relationship using the steps. Six and seven took a deep look at me and my character using the steps. Eight, nine, made amends as best I could, sitting in a chair in a crypt in Lancaster, New York. But the amends that I made was I decided I had told Eileen before that I would not drink. I would make every effort not to drink. I couldn't guarantee I wouldn't drink, but I'd make every effort not to. And this was that test. And I told her also that I was going to be making a living amends. So when she passed away on the 14th, just because she was gone doesn't mean that I was gone. And my amends, I felt that I still owed the amends to her. I was living my amends. I needed to continue making that. So on the 14th of every month, I've gone to the mausoleum and I've made amends to Eileen again, had our chat, had our conversation. And that's the way I've been maintaining it. I discovered that through using this program can provide me with the tools that I need to get through the most unimaginable difficulties. And if I put my trust in this program has never, ever let me down. I struggled with things right up through COVID. I got connected with you guys again in one of these God-guided moments. And since coming on here and with the isolation of COVID, I've developed a spiritual relationship with a higher power that I've lacked for years and years. I have to tell you, life is much better. My depth of understanding in the program is much better. It's given me the tools that I needed to get through something that I never thought I would get through. It's given me the strength to look ahead. And so now, when I walk into this place, I understand that if I walk into this place, I'm not going to find life here. But what I have to do is bring life into this place with me. And when I say that, it means bring the AA program into my life here. Bring that spiritual relationship into this place here. Bring the principles that I use for daily living here into home. And so that's what I try to do. Thanks to you guys, I've reconnected with the program to a depth that I never thought I could appreciate and even achieve. You've given me an understanding of self and spirituality and given me a sense of hope that I never had before. And I have to tell you, every time we finish one of these morning meetings, I walk out of here, I shut down, I walk away from my desk, and I feel a little bit better than when I walked in. And that has happened every single time I've sat down with you men in this meeting. So all I can say is I hope that as a result of my little chat this morning, maybe when you log off and walk out of here, maybe you can feel just a little bit better too, okay? Because I know I will be. So thanks for letting me share.